does, I think, doesn't it? And just to have a sense of this as a bit of a sanctuary where the wind is blowing and the rain is falling outside. And, you know, to give yourself, to give ourselves together this day as a time for practice and for settling and for reflecting together. So I hope the day of nourishment in various different domains. And yeah, good to get a sense actually of who's here and your experience in terms of, say, mindfulness-based approaches. I know this day has been advertised as being particularly with mindfulness teachers in mind, but whether you're a teacher or not, you're very, very welcome to be here. But it would just help us actually to know, could you just put a hand up if you are teaching mindfulness courses or training to teach mindfulness courses? Great, okay, very good. Thank you. And is there anyone who isn't familiar with the sort of 8-week course paradigm at all? Great, well, you're particularly welcome. Very good. Well, it's just very helpful to have that sense of, as Alex said, these sort of remarkable times in a certain way where these ancient teachings that we're reflecting on today are being presented in secular and very mainstream contexts. And it's part of that. That's part of the sort of crossover that we're going to be reflecting on a bit today. But let's start with a practice. We are intending that the day will have times of practice as well as discussion as well as teaching. But let's start with that, enacting that intention. So letting yourself find a way of sitting on this particular chair that supports settling. And an awakening into this moment's experience. Perhaps beginning by bringing mindfulness to mind in this moment, to the current state of mind, really turning towards and acknowledging how the mind is in this moment. Mind state, maybe simply sense the felt qualities of mind right now. As part of that, maybe noticing thinking patterns that may be reflecting or feeding the current state of mind, planning, remembering, judging. Noticing how the current mind state may also be resonating in the texture and tone of the body. Seeing if it's possible really to allow whatever you notice in mind and body in this moment. breathing with this moment's experience, however it is. And then bringing the attention more deliberately to the sensations of breathing. Gathering the attention into the movement of breathing, perhaps in the abdomen or the nostrils. Or if there's some other anchor that you're used to using for the attention, then devoting your attention in this moment to the sensations in that place. Letting this place really be in the foreground of your awareness in this moment. Everything else, other body sensations, mind states, thoughts and mental images, sounds, somewhat in the background. But letting the sensations of breathing or this other anchor point in the body that you're choosing really be known intimately, sensitively. Tenderly, even, with a friendliness of attention, moment by moment, breath by breath. And then when you're ready, letting the awareness expand around sensations of breathing or sensations in the anchor point that you've chosen. Expand around to include the whole sense of the body sitting here. Even the space around the body. As best you can, practicing this friendly sensitivity to the landscape of sensations as they change moment by moment. And really bringing this attitude of allowing that is so integral to a mindfulness approach, allowing your experience to be just as it is right now, however that is. Allowing mind and body to be like this. When you're ready, gradually making the transition back into the experience of seeing, if your eyes are a bit closed, or just a wider awareness of the room. Practicing sustaining this embodied awareness, bringing commitment to practicing mindfulness internally and externally as you open the eyes. And bringing a friendliness of awareness to your experiences. Can I just check about the volume? Can you hear at the back of the please will you, if at any stage during the day you can't hear, please will you wave. And just to say, we'll have a mid-morning break and pause, and then we'll break for lunch, I think around 1 o'clock. So just know that. But if you do need to, at any stage, go out and use the loo there, out of the door.
Okay, the first thing is, can everybody hear me with this little mic? Yep, good. Good morning, everybody. First of all. Okay, well, as many of you will know, particularly those who've been here before, this is part of a series of days that we've been giving over the last 2 years, I think it is now, where we've been basically going through the Satipatthana Sutta, this really primary text, and looking at each of the four ways of establishing mindfulness. So we're on to three. So we've got one more year to go yet. So we're on to the third. And just to recap for the, perhaps those who haven't been, or you know, just to refresh people's minds for those who have been, the foundations of mindfulness that we're looking at, that's the most common translation. Basically, the word Satipatthana means to establish. It's a way of establishing mindfulness. Or, let me move away from the word mindfulness, the ways of establishing present moment awareness. This is what we're doing, trying to establish present moment awareness. And we have four dimensions of our experience, which are constantly there. They're constantly accessible to us. The text itself is presented in a linear fashion. We go through body, we go through feelings, we go through mind, and then we go through the phenomena that constitute mind. But this doesn't mean that we have to practice this in this linear fashion. In fact, we can come into any dimension of this experience, or of our experience, at any one of these levels. We might want to look at mind, and then move to body, then move to feeling, and then move to this more abstract form, which we won't touch on today, which is basically called dhammas. The word in Pali and Sanskrit, dhammas or dharmas, which is basically the phenomena which is constituting our mental processes. These are accessible to us all the time. One of the teachers who I teach quite frequently with has a lovely analogy. He basically likens this to four channels on a television set, which are being constantly broadcast, and we can tune into them at any time. It's a lovely analogy. So they're accessible at any time, we've just got to tune into them. And so we started off with body a couple of years back by looking at the body. The body is the site of our being in the world. The body of our site of our interpersonal interactions. It's the site too often forgotten. And so the body makes it the primary source of establishing contact with something which is going on in the present moment. And that's the thing to remember. We're always touching base with what is actually happening in this present moment. That's the reason why this word sati, usually translated as mindfulness, is far better translated in some way which includes the notion of present moment. Present moment awareness, present moment recollection, both of these fit the bill quite well. We're recalling something which is actually taking place right here, right now. And we can tune into that in this way that was suggested by this particular teacher. The other way that we can establish mindfulness is by looking at a facet of our experience, which is what we would probably translate as the hedonic tone of our experience. It sounds a little bit technical, but it isn't. It just means the sense of pleasure or pain that's there. And pain we can use in a very loose sense, because it can just be irritation, it can be mild, mild embarrassment, it can be all sorts of aspects of our experience which are unpleasurable. And then there's the dimensions of our experience which are pleasurable. And there is also a third category which is said to be neither, which is really more like the absence of both of those other categories. Okay? I don't know about you, but I always find it's rather humbling that when we can reduce our experience to this. It's either pleasant, painful, or neither. In other words, let's put it in simple colloquial English. You like it, you don't like it, or you couldn't care less. Yeah. That's our experience. And a lot hangs on this experience, which we went into. Particularly the way that our experience is formed on the basis of the feeling tones of being in this world. And that's what we're really implying by this word hedonic. This feeling of pleasure or pain. Just at this stage, for those who might have seen this in popular books on Buddhism, this is not so much sensation. It's literally just the reception of painful or pleasant experience. That's usually categorized in forms of pleasurable bodily experience, so we don't actually move away from body experience, or unpleasurable bodily experience, or neither pleasurable or unpleasurable bodily experience. And then, again, it gets a little bit more subtle because it starts to talk about the experience of the mind in terms of those hedonic tones of pleasure, pain, or neither. A lot hangs on this because in one particular formulation of the Buddha, which is usually referred to as dependent origination, on contact with the world, contact with our thought processes, through our sense organs, of which the mind is considered to be yet another sense organ, immediately then Vedana, or this feeling tone, will arise. And on that experience of the feeling tone, we either move towards something or away from it. Let's forget about the neither category at the moment. We tend to overlook that most of the time. Most of our experiences are often perceived in the range of this pleasant or unpleasant. And as you can probably be aware, we are moving towards that which is pleasant and moving away from. A bit like the way that a flower will react to the sun. And move towards that which is pleasurable, move away from the darkness. So that sort of, that photosynthetic way that the plant deals with its environment is it moves that towards that which it perceives as being, I wouldn't say pleasurable, but that which is life-giving and that which is actually life-denying, or that which reduces our experience in some way to something which is uncomfortable or unpleasant. We are very much like that. And this is why this is such a large area. This is obviously not removed from the body, as I said before, because this is actually rooted in our bodily interactions with the world. Most of the basic practices that you are aware of, some of the practices that Chris just introduced just now, for example, focusing on the breath, this is mindfulness of body. Yeah, this is one of the primary practices that the Buddha introduces right in this section. Mindfulness of the body is mindfulness of breathing, what is known as anapanasati. Mindfulness of breathing, coming back to the breath. There are a whole range of practices, which I don't think we even covered particularly when we did this section, which are not so pleasurable, because they're usually about contemplations around death and contemplations around disintegration. Perfect way of honing the mind. They're often referred to as charnel or cremation ground contemplations. As one Zen poet said, upon spitting blood, it focuses the mind. Your projects and your concerns disappear. Yeah. And that's the reason partly for these practices, is actually to focus the mind on our corporeal existence and what is going on in the present moment. Yeah. So we have this in this basic starting place of the body, which is also an ending place. We don't move away from that, and we'll be referring to again to this today. Moving through feelings, connected with bodily environmental connectedness and the way these shape our experiences, which we'll talk about and expand a little bit, into this third stage, which we're moving into today, which is the mindfulness of mind. And the word that we're referring to is the word citta. I'll write this on the board in a second. But I'll pass it over to Chris to see if he wants to add something. Okay.
I think just to make the point that this map of experience or practice or these lenses that the Buddha is offering in the Satipatthana Sutta really are the arena within which mindfulness-based interventions were conceived and within which they're oriented. The body, which is so foundational in a mindfulness-based approach, isn't it? And the practices that we may encounter in these secular programs, body scanning, or mindfulness of breathing, absolutely coming from ground base of the Buddha's teaching that the body is the domain in which we can experience all that we need to know in order to awaken. The body is the arena within which we experience suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and within which we practice the path to the ending of the suffering. So the Four Noble Truths really experience within the domain of the body. And this second way of establishing mindfulness, this Vedana, so V-E-D-A-N-A, for those who are not familiar with it, such a helpful understanding that in a sense explains mindfulness-based approaches, really, because as John was saying, this reading of our experience in terms of pleasant, unpleasant, and neither, in a sense, that's not a problem, is it? The fact that our experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. That's sort of just how it is. The difficulty is, of course, the reactivity to that. So that sense that when we encounter pleasant experience, there's just this sort of biologically oriented reactivity that wants more. That we move towards, as John was giving the example of the flower. We can see just how hardwired this is within our systems. It's not something that, at some level, it's not something that we initially have much control over. But we can feel this movement towards the pleasant, and really crucially for mindfulness-based applications, and indeed for the Buddha's path of awakening, the reactivity to the unpleasant. The movement away from the unpleasant. And, when John Kabat-Zinn first started to bring mindfulness his moment in 1979, speaks about his 15 seconds in mindfulness in 1979 when he was on retreat at IMS with Christina Feldman and Christopher Titmus. And he just, in 15 seconds, he said it, suddenly he had a real sense of the potential of bringing these practices and this understanding to the patients in this very mainstream hospital in Worcester, Massachusetts, and seeing that the folk in the clinic there who were struggling with chronic pain, struggling with the sort of pain, as we know that if you've seen that moving film about it, the doctors were saying, "Look, I'm sorry, there's nothing else we can do." And John really identified the reactivity to unpleasant sensations in the body. How crucial that is in terms of the suffering we add, if you like, the optional suffering we add to the unavoidable discomfort of life. And really finding ways over an 8-week, the experiment of creating mindfulness-based stress reduction. Well, what is the stress that's reduced? It's the reactivity. It's the stress, the dukkha, the dis-ease that's generated by the reactivity to those patterns of chronic pain. Discovering that actually when that reactivity is diminished through turning towards the sensations with a curiosity and a greater friendliness, a willingness to allow, a willingness to breathe with rather than brace against the pain. Discovering something radical happens, something radically shifts in that experience. And people, finding that their levels of pain, their perceived levels of pain, significantly reduce as a result. And of course then, when John Teasdale, Mark Williams, and Zimbel Siegel were charged with finding a cognitive therapeutic intervention to help, to give to people who were in remission from episodes of depression, getting really interested in, what is it that triggers depressive relapse? What's the moment, or what's the pattern of events that triggers depressive relapse? Which is a really key moment to be interested in, isn't it? Both personally, but also sort of socially, and in terms of resources that are available to people struggling with depression, and discovering it's reactivity, cognitive reactivity to the unpleasant Vedana of ordinary low mood. Does that make sense? So, we all of us wake up on certain mornings feeling a bit cranky, don't we? The body feels presents unpleasant Vedana, And we look outside and it's cold and it's raining, and the mood may be lower. The mood may be more unpleasant. And what they saw was it's the reactivity to the unpleasant Vedana of that. So here we are with the first of these three ways of establishing mindfulness, all present in that moment. That there's a mind state that is unpleasant, has an unpleasant Vedana, and it's resonating in the body, and it's the reactivity, the sort of don't like that, got to get rid of it. So what happens, of course, if we've had a history of that depression, just like if we've had a history, like most of us have, of anxiety, what happens is the mind gets jangly and agitated trying to get rid of it. And the cognitive bit is the thinking patterns that are triggered that say, here I am again, back in this low place, nothing's worked, what am I going to do, what does this mean about me, what does this mean about my future? And we're back into the rumination that is the activity of depression. Rumination is an aspect of this third way of establishing mindfulness, starting to become aware of mental habits, mental states, and the cognitive patterns within them. And that's the sort of spiral downwards, is that reactivity to the unpleasant Vedana of the ordinary low mood. Does this make sense? Because I tell you, when I've been sort of practicing in the Dharma context for quite a while, and then read this great book, the Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Depression, and just was sort of so appreciated the precision of that seeing, and also the beautiful way in which that these ways of establishing mindfulness are describe that moment, describe these experiences, are interacting ways. I think my only reservation about Akinchino's channels analogy is that, of course, we want an analogy where these different channels are interacting with each other, because they do. They're not three separate channels. Does that make sense? So it's the Vedana of the sort of Vedana of the second way of establishing mindfulness, of the third way of establishing mindfulness, and the way it's echoing in the first way of establishing mindfulness, the body. It's a very sort of, it's a holistic experience in that way. But what a, this it's such a beautiful teaching, isn't it, the Satipatthana, because it just provides such a clear and clarifying lens on experience. That we're bringing our reflections today to this sense. Well, how do we relate to mental states and the cognitive processes that feed them? And particularly, how do we relate to the Vedana of them, the tone of them, which is really, as the Buddha's highlighting, is absolutely crucial for the degree of well-being, or the degree of equanimity, or the sort of resilience of our compassion.
Okay, so we're moving into this whole arena of mindfulness of mind. Well, the first thing we need to do is actually have the word, which is this word, chitta. If I can find a used piece of last one. Okay, this is the word, chitta. It's interesting when we look through this particular text, because these four ways of establishing mindfulness, which we've gone through, and Chris has gone through, connecting it with obviously what we're doing in MBSR and MBCT. Body. Feeling. Body is the largest section out of the whole of this text. This is making it quite clear, this is so central to what is actually happening in this process, of this process of becoming aware, this process of becoming mindful. The feeling section is a little shorter. The mindfulness of mind section is extremely short. And interesting, Ed, about you, when I first came across this, I thought, well, this ought to be a big section. It ought to be a huge section, because minds are complicated. Yeah? But it isn't. It's a very short section. And I think we'll read this to you in a second, this particular section. This word, chitta, is only one of many, many words which are used by the Buddha to describe mental function. It has different meanings. And I don't want to make this into a linguistic class, but it's worth knowing what this word means, because in Pali, the language is actually exactly the same as Sanskrit as well. In Pali, this word is what is called a passive past participle. The word you've got to hear is passive. So ways of translating this, and I'll come back to this notion of passivity, the ways of translating this are as state of mind, or even consciousness as well. We have some other contenders for this word for mind as well, which is this word vijnana. And manas. These words are nearly all used by the Buddha in these early texts synonymously. They're used almost interchangeably. But sometimes they have different meanings in different contexts. And when we're looking at this particular text, the mindfulness of mind part of the Satipatthana Sutta, we're very much looking at this word citta. And we're looking at it as this notion, particularly of state of mind. One other way of translating this is literally a thought. This is another way of translating this notion. It comes from another particular Pali word, which I won't go into, which is actually looking at thought functioning within within mental processes. Coming back to the passive notion of this. So, this is really important from a practice point of view, because what are we being asked to do in a sense, taking up this position of mindfulness of mind? What we're being asked to do is not look at a process, not look at an entity, but look at something which is literally taking place at this moment. What is, and with a better way of perhaps forming this, is what is the state of your mind? What is the state of your mind at this moment? This is much more in line with the sense that the Pali has. So when you're being asked to introspect in this particular way, look at the quality, because this is a qualitative look at your mind. What state is that mind at this moment? How do you experience it? There's a refrain that goes with this, which runs the whole way through this text. It runs from the body section, it runs in the feeling section, and it runs particularly in this section as well. And it's an interesting phrase, because in the body section it says, to see the body as body, to see feelings as feelings, to see mind as mind. Almost sounds very tautological. To see body as body, to see feelings as feeling, to see mind as mind, from the Buddhist perspective, is not to see them as some kind of entity, which is a self, as a fixed entity. This is an extremely important part, because what we're not doing is introspecting a self. This was very important in the Buddha's own time, because people, particularly with the notion of citta, associated the notion of citta as being the real self. That consciousness, states of mind, were the real you. And so there was an equation in the Upanishads, some of you might know these texts, which was that citta equaled Brahman. It was a macrocosm, microcosm view. But the macrocosm was also conscious. And it was called Brahman, which is again, it's neuter in the original language. It's not gendered, it's not a god. It's a sort of ontological basis of everything. You know, if you want to really know what everything was composed of in that time, it was Brahman. The microcosmic bit was within each of us, that was connected to this macrocosm, was citta, was consciousness. So somehow we were part of a whole. The Buddha wanted to move away from this because this gave a static notion of what consciousness and mental functioning was about, and turned it into a thing. I don't know if you get that, whether that makes sense at this stage. Yeah. When you have this equation of citta equals Brahman, what we're talking about is unchanging phenomena. Yeah, if you want to know what everything is composed of, the backcloth of all of experience, it's like the great cosmic screen upon which everything is projected. Well, that would be Brahman. The part of that's going on in the individual is the citta, the consciousness. Now, I'm only giving you that as a background to make sense of what the Buddha is really trying to do with this. He's trying to make this much more personal. That within each of us, is something which is what he's terming mind, chitta, vijnana, manas, all of these terms with slightly different meanings but often overlapping, are describing mental functioning. They're describing the way our minds work. And why is this important? Well, let me give you a quotation, particularly about if we translate chitta as thought. The world, bhikkhu is just a term for, well, what we call monks, although it doesn't really mean monks in the original language. The world, bhikkhu, is led by thoughts. It's carried along by thoughts. It proceeds under the control of thoughts which have arisen. When the Buddha speaks about world, he's talking about the world of experience. He's not talking about a world which is simply out there. And this is extremely important, and this is something we're going to keep coming back to, is that your experience of your world is being formed by what is going on in your mind. And your body as well. And your feelings. All interacting. So in other words, world isn't something which is passively received by us. It is something that's being generated by our interactions with it. So we are implicated in the building of worlds. We're implicated, particularly coming back to what Chris was saying earlier on, in building a world of reactivity. We're implicated in building a world often that has a certain feeling tone to it. Irritation, unpleasantness, or whatever it might be. So what is important here is that notion of world building, world generating. So whenever you come across, if you do read these texts, whenever you come across this word world, or what is being translated as world, don't see it as something simply out there which we are passively receiving. We're constantly engaged with that and shaping that world through the quality of our experience, and particularly the quality of our minds. Remember these possible translations: state of mind, mood. Let's just focus on that one for a second, and I'll pass it back to Chris. Mood. Can I suggest something to you? Is you're always in a mood. You're never not in a mood. When you wake up in the morning, you're in a mood. When you go to bed at night, you're in a mood. Often to the annoyance of those around you. You would have probably noticed. So, moodedness, let's put it in a slightly more technical term, state of mind, is fundamental to our world shaping, to our world building. I'm going to give you a very well-known quotation, just to finish this section off with. Virtually everybody has heard this at some stage around MBCT, MBSR, or certainly around Buddhist circles, and it's the first passage out of the Dhammapada, which is a very ancient collection of aphorisms, basically. And the Buddha says this: preceded by mind are phenomena, led by mind, formed by mind. If with mind polluted one speaks or acts, then pain follows, as a wheel follows the draft ox's foot. Preceded by mind are phenomena, led by mind, formed by mind. If with a mind that is pure one speaks or acts, then ease follows, as an ever-present shadow follows one. That is, in a sense, the classic statement of why mindfulness of mind is important. Pain or unhappiness is going to follow our ways of world building, our ways of thinking, our ways of processing what is out there. So, although we're talking about a state of mind as a passive thing, we're introspecting that at this moment, but it is also going to change. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cough.
Let me pass that to you.
So you might like just to check in with yourself right now. What is the state of mind? Sometimes we can name a mood that's present, or more than one mood that's present. Sometimes it's more just sensing the quality of mind in this moment. Noticing thought patterns that are inflecting this moment's experience somehow. I really appreciate Nyanaponika Thera. Some of you will know Nyanaponika Thera's book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, which is really a book about the Satipatthana Sutta. He says this path has three aspects to it. Knowing the mind, shaping the mind, and freeing the mind. And just that knowing, how fun. He says, actually, when he introduces it, he says, this mind that is so near to us and yet so unknown. Do you feel that? I find that such a sort of, somehow rings so true, doesn't it? That this mind state is just the most intimate thing in terms of the experience of this moment, and yet, so often, I'm not mindful of it. I'm not knowing it. And yet, as John was saying, you know, it is shaping the world of the moment, isn't it? It is truly shaping the world of the moment. And isn't it so interesting to notice, to ask that question, well, how is the mood or mindset of this moment shaping the experience of self in this moment, of others in this moment, the perceptions of time in this moment, the sense of space or constriction that is experienced in this moment? It's really helpful to notice that. And of course, in MBCT, which is the program I know better, I should say this, and some of you will be more familiar with MBSR, so it'd be really good to hear your equivalents. But there are a couple of exercises, aren't there, in MBCT, where there's an invitation to reflect on the impact of mood on perception. There's one that's sometimes called the general office example, where you're going into the office in a you know, bouncy mood because something's gone well, and a colleague walks towards you and then just doesn't really sort of pay attention to you and walks off. How do you experience that when you're in a good mood and when you're in a more negative mood, when things are not going so well? And we see, you know, that's just a little glimpse into the profound nature of world shaping that mood enacts. John read that first verse from the Dhammapada from a new translation, which is great. I also love Gil Fronsdal's translation, who puts it like this: all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. I mean, probably it's hard to think of a more profound statement than that at some level. You know, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. You know, the mind of the moment creates the world of the moment. And this is part of what the Buddha means, the language of emptiness that comes up in Buddhism, means that, you know, these are fabricated by mind. Perception fabricates experience. And really to sort of take that on board, you know, as part of this first step of knowing the mind, shaping the mind, freeing the mind, knowing the mind. knowing it richly with that awareness, okay, there is like in the first step of the breathing space where we say, okay, what's the current mind state? Okay, you recognize, oh, interested or bored or irritated or content or whatever it is. And then also just that sense of, and how is that shaping the world of the moment? Because as John said, when the Buddha, certainly in the early text, uses this word loka in the work, he's meaning the sort of subjective world of experience. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so helpful, you know, those, well, all of us who are practitioners and also those who are teachers, really to make this practice of pausing and knowing the mind in the moment. It's very simple, somewhat elusive, because often we can't name it. You notice that there's something about moods or mind states that you can say, well, it's contracted or, yeah, it's expansive, but somehow the felt sense of the mind in the moment has to go beyond words, doesn't it? It's got a sort of felt quality to it. And I always feel like it doesn't matter if you can't name it. You know, you don't have to think, well, what's the difference between restless and antsy? You know, one's not getting caught up in trying to find the right name, but it's more the sort of apprehension of, oh, this moment is like this. You know? I really appreciate the practice of using that acronym RAIN, which some of you, yeah, just hands up who's familiar with the acronym, right? Okay, so yeah, quite a few people. But it's really helpful for this practice of mindfulness of mind. It stands for recognize, allow, investigate, and non-identification, or not self, we could put it. But just how crucial that first step is of recognizing. You know, just the question, what's happening? Yeah. We needed a question that awakens mindfulness. The question, what's happening? What's the attitude of mind right now? What's happening? And often that's enough. Do you notice that? That sometimes if one's stuck in a mood, you say, okay, what's up? Oh, there's anxiety here. Just the recognizing often just sort of something eases. Do we feel that? Do you notice that? Because it's almost like we're sort of easily in an unconscious state of anxiety or fear or irritation or something. And it's driving the morning and shaping the world that I'm living in and the interactions, how I'm perceiving self and other and time and all of that, shaping it. But it's unconscious, you know. And then actually just to pause and feel the feet and take a breath and say, what's happening? Oh, there's fear here. There's anxiety here. You know, just that knowing of the mind in itself can be so helpful. Particularly if there is that sense of knowing and allowing. Because it's the allowing, well, it's the knowing and the allowing that soften the relationship with the Vedana, isn't it? You know, because the Vedana, the unpleasantness of the anxiety is what's keeping me in a sort of driven dither mode, creating all these worlds of irritation through the day or whatever it is. And actually the recognizing, okay, irritation. Just bringing mindfulness to that contact with the mood, the Vedana mood. And just allowing it so that I'm not adding aversion to the irritation. How helpful that is. How helpful that is.
Yeah, I'll just like say one thing then. I think one of the things I just really want to say on the back of what Chris has just said, I think it's a really important thing, which is we think about our relationship with the world, we never live in a non-interpreted world. Our world is constantly being interpreted. If you want to place yourself in the position, you're constantly reading your experience. And it's as if you were reading them sometimes through a particular pair of glasses, which has a certain tint to it. but you don't take your glasses off to see how it really is. Yeah. Perhaps you wouldn't see anything like me. But you don't actually take them off. So our world, this world that we're inhabiting, this loka, is a constantly interpreted world. This mind, which we think is so personal, is often being shaped also by forces which which are outside of ourselves. Yeah. Social, historic conditions, linguistic conditions, all sorts of conditions, which are shaping that mind, shaping those mood states through which we're seeing the world, and then adding in the thing that Chris is saying right at the end of the RAIN acronym, not to do, but we do build in identification, as if it's all about me. This world is all about me, and we take it very personally. So if you think that about that in the dynamic of your own life, the way this feeling of the mind seems to be so intimate and personal, but it's often being shaped by forces which are outside of ourselves, of which we are actually then taking personal responsibility for. Yeah? I don't know if you can see that. Being embodied, coming back to this first starting point that the Buddha is talking about, being embodied means that we're in a world, no matter whether we want to think of ourselves as cut off or not, we're in a world with others. We're in a social world. That world is shaping, and that body itself, which is being, in a sense, being played on also by social forces, is also shaping that mind. Yeah. Contemporary thinkers like Michel Foucault and that make this very clear, that you know, the body isn't simply a body. The body is also being shaped by forces, and our mind is being shaped by forces. Yet the point that we often enter into, particularly in practice, is that we've introspect our minds, and we're taking this very personally, because we're adding in the sense of identification of being my mind. And I've got to do something about my mind. Yeah? And it becomes another project that we have to then deal with. Yeah? Yet the strange thing is, often this my mind, which is so intimate, or seemingly intimate, is very much an unknown, unexplored territory. And mindfulness of mind is about the basic starting to explore this, but from that position of non-identification. From that very different position of, let's come and have a take and look what's going on. Let's just see what's going on. I often start off, and Chris well knows this, I often start off retreats, Vipassana retreats, saying, here's your mantra for the week. What the hell's going on here? Yeah. That, because that actually is what we're engaging in. We're engaging in this exploration of our mind bodies. What's actually going on here? Because it seems to be so perspicuous, so clear to us, but it isn't. And so much of that reactivity, this personalization, identification, is going on because of that lack of clarity. So mindfulness of mind is bringing, in a sense, a degree of clarity to the mental processes, so that we understand what is here at this moment. How is this mind at this moment?
That's what I'm thinking about. Just to add something to that, I really appreciate what John was saying there, because it's so easy to have a sense of my mind is a problem, and we project this sort of past and future to it, don't we? And I've got this mind thing, like, it's a problem. And actually, part of the beautiful freeing of what the Buddha's saying is, just hold the mirror up to it now. Don't project time, you know, backwards and forwards, and which turns it into a self and turns it into a problem so easily.
But just have a sense of, okay, what's the mind state now? I mean, it's the single most valuable thing, question we could be asking today to awaken a mindfulness of mind, is what's happening now, as John said. And that sense of not having to carry this burden of my mind. Does that make sense? Where we make it into a thing, like this sort of, you know, weight we've got to work with. And actually the Buddha's saying, be momentary about this. Be momentary about the mind, rather than telling a story of a problem over time. And that's very, you know, the implications of that are so radical and actually so liberating. Because in a sense we can see that if we can bring mindfulness, bring an awareness to this current moment's experience, this right now is where liberation is either found or lost. And the Buddha is truly not saying I have to get rid of all the difficult mind states in order to have a mindfulness, to be mindful, you know. So I can have mindfulness of fear, despair, confusion. And that knowing, bringing that quality of a friendly curiosity to this moment's experience, this is where the liberation happens. It doesn't happen some other time. It happens now, through the quality that we bring to the mind of the moment. And it's radically, we can sometimes have this slightly sort of post-Freudian model where I've got all this stuff with my mind that I just have to keep bringing up and keep bringing up, and you know, got years and years of therapy to bring up all my story. And part of what's so radical about Buddha's teaching is he says it's the conditions right now that determine suffering or the absence of suffering. So change the conditions of the moment, and the whole perception of, you know, memory and imprinting of the past is changed. You know, the whole relationship with it has changed. So it's a very present moment experience. And there's huge implications for that in terms of how we see and relate to the experience of mind. Should we...